Chapter 12. Hitherto been inaccessible, even to highly placed French officials, and there was a special sense of excitement in taking the road that led to it. We slipped through a valley or two, past some placid villages with vine-covered gables, and noticed that most of the signs over the shops were German. We had crossed the old frontier unawares, and were presently in the charming town of Massivox. It was the Feast of the Assumption, and Mass was just over when we reached the square before the church. The streets were full of holiday people, well-dressed, smiling, seemingly unconscious of the war. Down the church steps, guided by fond mamas, came little girls in white dresses, with white wreaths in their hair, and carrying, in baskets slung over their shoulders, woolly lambs or blue and white virgins. Groups of cavalry officers stood chatting with civilians, in their Sunday best, and through the windows of the Golden Eagle we saw active preparations for a crowded midday dinner. It was all as happy and parochial as a fancy picture, and the fine old gabled houses and clean cobblestone streets made the traditional setting for an Alsatian holiday. At the Golden Eagle we laid in a store of provisions, and started out across the mountains, in the direction of Than. The Vosges, at this season, are in their short midsummer beauty, rustling with streams, dripping with showers, balmy with the smell of firs and bracken, and of purple thyme on hot banks. We reached the top of a ridge, and, hiding the motor behind a skirt of trees, went out into the open, to lunch on a sunny slope. Facing us across the valley was a tall conical hill clothed with forest. That hill was Hartmannswillerkopf, the center of a long contest in which the French have lately been victorious. And all about us stood other crests and ridges from which German guns still look down on the valley of Than. Than itself is at the valley head, in a neck between hills, a handsome old town, with the air of prosperous stability so oddly characteristic of this tormented region. As we drove through the main street, the pall of war sadness fell on us again, darkening the light and chilling the summer air. Than is raked by the German lines, and its windows are mostly shuttered, and its streets deserted. One or two houses in the cathedral square have been gutted, but the somewhat over-pinnacled and statued cathedral which is the pride of Than is almost untouched, and when we entered it vespers were being sung, and a few people mostly in black knelt in the nave. No greater contrast could be imagined to the happy feast day scene we had left, a few miles off, at Massivox. But Than, in spite of its empty streets, is not a deserted city. A vigorous life beats in it, ready to break forth, as soon as the German guns are silenced. The French administration, working on the best of terms with the population, are keeping up the civil activities of the town as the canons of the cathedral are continuing the rites of the church. Many inhabitants still remain behind their closed shutters, and dive down into their cellars when the shells begin to crash, and the schools, transferred to a neighboring village, number over 2,000 pupils. We walked through the town, visited a vast catacomb of a wine cellar fitted up partly as an ambulance, and partly as a shelter for the cellarless, and saw the lamentable remains of the industrial quarter along the river, which has been the special target of the German guns. Than has been industrially ruined, all its mills are wrecked. But unlike the towns of the north, it has had the good fortune to preserve its outline, its civic personality, a face that its children, when they come back, can recognize and take comfort. Inches after our visit to the ruins, a diversion was suggested by the amiable administrators of Than who had guided our sightseeing. They were just off for a military tournament which the TH Dragoons were giving that afternoon in a neighboring valley, and we were invited to go with them. The scene of the entertainment was a meadow enclosed in an amphitheater of rocks, with grassy ledges projecting from the cliff-like tiers of opera boxes. These points of vantage were partly occupied by interested spectators and partly by ruminating cattle. On the lowest slope, the rank and fashion of the neighborhood, was ranged on a semicircle of chairs, and below, in the meadow, a lively steeplechase was going on. The riding was extremely pretty, as French military riding always is. Few of the mounts were thoroughbreds, the greater number, in fact, being local cart horses barely broken to the saddle, but their agility and dash did the greater credit to their riders. The Lancers, in particular, executed an effective musical ride about a central pennon, to the immense satisfaction of the fashionable public in the foreground, and of the gallery on the rocks. The audience was even more interesting than the artists. Chatting with the ladies, in the front row were the general of division and his staff, groups of officers invited from the adjoining headquarters, and most of the civil and military administrators of the restored Epartement du Haut-Rhin. All classes had turned out in honor of the fete, and everyone was in a holiday mood. The people among whom we sat were mostly Alsatian property owners, many of them industrials of Thann. Some had been driven from their homes, others had seen their mills destroyed, all had been living for a year on the perilous edge of war, under the menace of reprisals too hideous to picture. Yet the humor prevailing was that of any group of merrymakers in a peaceful garrison town. I have seen nothing, in my wanderings along the front, more indicative of the good breeding of the French than the spirit of the ladies and gentlemen who sat chatting with the officers on that grassy slope of Alsace. The display of haute ecole was to be followed by an exhibition of transportation throughout the ages, headed by a Gaulish chariot driven by a trooper with a long horsehair mustache and mistletoe wreath, and ending in a motor of which the engine had been taken out, and replaced by a large placid white horse. Unluckily a heavy rain began, while this instructive hummer awaited its turn, and we had to leave before Vercingetorix had led his warriors into the ring. August 16th. Up and up into the mountains. We started early, taking our way along a narrow interminable valley that sloped up gradually toward the east. The road was encumbered with a stream of hooded supply vans drawn by mules, for we were on the way to one of the main positions in the Vosges, and this train of provisions is kept up day and night. Finally we reached a mountain village under fir-clad slopes, with a cold stream rushing down from the hills. On one side of the road was a rustic inn, on the other, among the firs, a chalet occupied by the brigade headquarters. Everywhere about us swarmed the little Hussars Alpins in blue tam-o'-shanters and leather gaiters. For a year we had been reading of these heroes of the hills, and here we were among them, looking into their thin weather-beaten faces and meeting the twinkle of their friendly eyes. Very friendly they all were, and yet, for Frenchmen, inarticulate and shy. All over the world, no doubt, the mountain silences breed this kind of reserve, this shrinking from the glibness of the valleys. Yet one had fancied that French fluency must soar as high as Mont Blanc. Mules were brought, and we started on a long ride up the mountain. The way led first over open ledges, with deep views into valleys blue with distance, then through miles of forest, first of beech and fir, and finally all of fir. Above the road the wooded slopes rose interminably, and here and there we came on tiers of mules, 300 or 400 together, stabled under the trees, in stalls dug out of different levels of the slope. Nearby were shelters for the men, and perhaps at the next bend a village of rappers' huts, as the officers call the log cabins they build in this region. These colonies are always bustling with life. Men busy cleaning their arms, hauling material for new cabins, washing or mending their clothes, or carrying down the mountain from the camp kitchen the two-handled pails full of steaming soup. The kitchen is always in the most protected quarter of the camp, and generally at some distance in the rear. Other soldiers, their job over, are lolling about in groups, smoking, gossiping, or writing home, the old year's letter pad propped on a patched blue knee, a scarred fist laboriously driving the fountain pen received in hospital. Some are leaning over the shoulder of a pal who has just received a Paris paper, others chuckling together at the jokes of their own French journal, the Chaux du Raven, the Ornel des Poilus, or the Diable Blue. little papers ground out in purplish script on fool's cap, and adorned with comic sketches and a wealth of local humor. Higher up, under a fur belt, at the edge of a meadow, the officer who rode ahead signed to us to dismount and scramble after him. We plunged under the trees, into what seemed a thicker thicket, and found it to be a thatch of branches woven to screen the muzzles of a battery. The big guns were all about us, crouched in these sylvan lairs like wild beasts waiting to spring, and near each gun hovered its attendant gunner, proud, possessive, important as a bridegroom with his bride. We climbed and climbed again, reaching at last a sun and wind-burnt common which forms the top of one of the highest mountains in the region. The forest was left below us, and only a belt of dwarf firs ran along the edge of the great grassy shoulder. We dismounted, the mules were tethered among the trees, and our guide led us to an insignificant-looking stone in the grass. On one face of the stone was cut the letter F, on the other was a D. We stood on what, till a year ago, was the boundary line between Republic and Empire. Since then, in certain places, the line has been bent back a long way, but where we stood we were still under German guns, and we had to creep along in the shelter of the squat firs to reach the outlook on the edge of the plateau. From there, under a sky of racing clouds, we saw outstretched below us the promised land of Alsace. On one horizon, far off in the plain, gleamed the roofs and spires of Colmar, on the other rose the purplish heights beyond the Rhine. Nearby stood a ring of bare hills, those closest to us scarred by ridges of upheaved earth, as if giant moles had been zigzagging over them, and just under us, in a little green valley, lay the roofs of a peaceful village. The earth ridges and the peaceful village were still German, but the French positions went down the mountain, almost to the valley's edge, and one dark peak on the right was already French. We stopped at a gap in the firs, and walked to the brink of the plateau. Just under us lay a rock-rimmed lake. More zigzag earthworks surmounted it on all sides, and on the nearest shore was the branched roofing of another great mule shelter. We were looking down at the spot to which the night caravans of the Chasseurs Alpins descend to distribute supplies to the fighting line. Who goes there? Attention! You're in sight of the lines! A voice called out from the firs, and our companion signed to us to move back. We had been rather too conspicuously facing the German batteries on the opposite slope, and our presence might have drawn their fire on an artillery observation post installed nearby. We retreated hurriedly, and unpacked our luncheon basket on the more sheltered side of the ridge. As we sat there in the grass, swept by a great mountain breeze full of the scent of thyme and myrtle, while the flutter of birds, the hum of insects, the still and busy life of the hills, went on all about us in the sunshine, the pressure of the encircling line of death grew more intolerably real. It is not in the mud, and jokes and everyday activities of the trenches, that one most feels the damnable insanity of war. It is where it lurks like a mythical monster in scenes to which the mind has always turned for rest. We had not yet made the whole tour of the mountaintop, and after luncheon we rode over to a point where a long narrow yoke connects it with a spur projecting directly above the German lines. We left our mules in hiding, and walked along the yoke, a mere knife edge of rock rimmed with dwarf vegetation. Suddenly we heard an explosion behind us. One of the batteries we had passed on the way up was giving tongue. The German lines roared back, and for 20 minutes the exchange of invective thundered on. The firing was almost incessant. It seemed as if a great arch of steel were being built up above us in the crystal air, and we could follow each curve of sound from its incipience to its final crash in the trenches. There were 4 distinct phases. The sharp bang from the cannon, the long furious howl overhead, the dispersed and spreading noise of the shell's explosion, and then the roll of its reverberation from cliff to cliff. This is what we heard as we crouched in the lee of the firs. What we saw when we looked out between them was only an occasional burst of white smoke, and red flame from one hillside, and on the opposite one, a minute later, a brown geyser of dust. Presently a deluge of rain descended on us, driving us back to our mules, and down the nearest mountain trail through rivers of mud. It rained all the way. Rained in such floods and cataracts, that the very rocks of the mountain seemed to dissolve, and turn into mud. As we slid down through it, we met strings of chasseurs alpins coming up, splashed to the waist with wet red clay, and leading pack mules so coated with it, that they looked like studio models from which the sculptor has just pulled off the dripping sheet. Lower down we came on more wrapper settlements, so saturated and reeking with wet, that they gave us a glimpse of what the winter months on the front must be. No more cheerful polishing of firearms, hauling of faggots, chatting, and smoking in sociable groups. Everybody had crept under the doubtful shelter of branches and tarpaulins. The whole army was back in its burrows. August 17th. Sunshine again for our arrival at Belfort. The invincible city lies unpretentiously behind its green glasses and escutcheon gates. But the guardian lion under the citadel well, the lion is figuratively as well as literally a l'auteur. With the sunset flush on him, as he crouched aloft in his red lair below the fort, he might almost have claimed kin with his mighty prototypes of the Assurbanipal frieze. One wondered a little, seeing whose work he was, but probably it is easier for an artist to symbolize an heroic town than the abstract and elusive divinity who sheds light on the world from New York Harbor. From Belfort back into reconquered Alsace the road runs through a gentle landscape of fields and orchards. We were bound for Danemary, one of the towns of the plain, and a center of the new administration. It is the usual rose borg of Alsace, with comfortable old houses in espaliered gardens. Dull, well-to-do, contented. Not in the least the kind of setting demanded by the patriotism which has to be fed on pictures of little girls singing the Marseillaise in Alsatian headdresses, and old men with operatic waistcoats tottering forward to kiss the flag. What we saw at Danemary was less conspicuous to the eye, but much more nourishing to the imagination. The military and civil administrators had the kindness and patience to explain their work and show us something of its results, and the visit left one with the impression of a slow and quiet process of adaptation wisely planned and fruitfully carried out. We did, in fact, hear the schoolgirls of Danemary sing the Marseillaise and the boys too, but, what was far more interesting, we saw them studying under the direction of the teachers who had always had them in charge, and found that everywhere it had been the aim of the French officials to let the routine of the village policy go on undisturbed. The German signs remain over the shop fronts except where the shopkeepers have chosen to paint them out, as is happening more and more frequently. When a functionary has to be replaced, he is chosen from the same town or the same district, and even the personnel of the civil and military administration is mainly composed of officers and civilians of Alsatian stock. The heads of both these departments, who accompanied us on our rounds, could talk to the children and old. Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.